Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and today on the program I'm speaking with Lawrence S. Whitner, an award-winning American historian, writer, and activist for peace and social justice. Professor Whitner is the author or editor of a dozen books and the writer of over 250 published articles and book reviews, mostly on issues of peace, war, and international relations. He's also a former editor of Peace and Change, a journal of peace research. He has received the New York State United University Professions Excellent Award for Scholarship, Teaching, and Service, and the Peace History Society's Lifetime Achievement Award. For over half a century, Professor Whitner has participated in the racial equality, labor, and peace movements. Numerous organizations have presented him with awards for his activism. Currently, he's a national board member of Peace Action and the executive secretary of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. He's just written and had a book published called Working for Peace and Justice, his autobiography published by the University of Tennessee Press. Lawrence Whitner joins us now on the line. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Larry.
Thank you very much, Helen. I'm delighted to be on the program.
Yes. Now, your book is very comprehensive about your life, and I'd like to start right at the beginning with your origins and your roots in Poland, if I may. Would you like to tell the audience where you arose and how you got to be in America, in fact? What happened in Poland?
Well, I wasn't born there, but my grandparents and ancestors before them were, at least on my mother's side. My grandfather was a textile mill worker in Russian Poland during the late 19th century, and he fled at the time he was drafted into the Tsar's army. I didn't know that until many years later, years later after I became an activist myself, but I was delighted to learn of this early dissonance on his part. And on my father's side of the family, they came from Austria-Hungary, although in a region that's today part of the Ukraine. Both regions, from my mother's and father's side of the family, were in the Pale of Settlement. That area in which the Jewish population was confined, thanks to discrimination against Jews, and they were all Jewish. So these grandparents came to the United States. They settled in New York City. On my mother's side, Abraham Barnatsky, who became Abraham Barnett, became a loom fixer in the Paterson, New Jersey silk mills, and he did that for the rest of his working life. And my father's father came to the United States, also lived in the New York City region. He set up a small family fur business, making fur hats and later fur coats. And their children, my father and mother, were both born in the United States and became thoroughly assimilated New Yorkers. My father ultimately worked for the New York State Commission Against Discrimination, an early civil rights agency in the United States. And my mother, for a time, was a legal stenographer But eventually she stayed home after my birth and became a Brooklyn, New York housewife. And I was raised in Brooklyn.
I was recently in Brooklyn. It's very fascinating because it's having a renaissance, a revival. But I was very fascinated by your story, Larry, because, in fact, my maiden name is Bronowski. And my great-grandfather was the White Russian Army came to recruit him to the army. And had he been recruited, he would have been sent to Siberia, probably, which happened to a lot of aristocratic or Jewish young men. I don't know if my origins are Jewish or not. I'm interested to find out. But he escaped with the help of the maid by tying sheets together and getting down from the third floor of their home. He fled to Austria, thence to England, never saw his family again, never, came to Australia, and there he drew all the birds and mammals of Australia. So he became kind of the Audubon, if you will, of Australia. So I think we have origins in common in that respect, Larry.
Yes, it certainly sounds like it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? So now I want to know why you were fascinated in becoming an intellectual from the history that you just gave us about your childhood. It didn't seem a very intellectual background, except I suppose your parents were very intelligent. But what influences led you to become an intellectual, Larry Whitner?
Well, in fact, my father was the first member of his family to ever go to college. And he only did that after working during the day for his father's fur business. So there was very little intellectual history in my family. However, I was a bright and sensitive child, and I preferred staying home and reading books to going out and playing baseball or stickball or basketball with the boys on my block in Brooklyn. So from an early age, I was very bookish and learned a great deal in that way. I had nothing that really reinforced that bookishness. My parents certainly didn't mind it, although they urged me to go outside and play baseball, which I didn't do very frequently. But it wasn't until college where it actually began to pay off in terms of having a circle of bright friends who read books and discussed ideas. So actually, there was fairly little in my childhood to prepare me for that role.
Were you an only child, Larry?
I did have a sister, and she was less bookish than I. She was fairly attractive, and I think that actually led her into a more conventional role.
Yeah. And also, interestingly, you said you were a stutterer, and that inhibited you too in your childhood from participating socially too much, and that was one of the reasons you retreated to books. Is that right?
I think so. I still don't speak very smoothly, but I speak somewhat better than I did then. But I'm sure that helped lead me to a sort of isolated, reclusive life rather than to the life of socializing with others and going out and running around the Brooklyn streets with the other boys.
Right. So, okay, now, what influences in your childhood led you to become, quotes, an activist, in quotes?
Well, I didn't know of my mother's father's history as a critic of the armed forces, or at least somebody who wasn't going to serve in the armed forces.
In Russia.
And I might add, he'd been active in the Bund, the Jewish socialist movement of Poland at the time. That was seeking to overthrow the Tsar and create a more equitable society. So I didn't know that at the time. There was no family history that I knew of in that connection. However, I began to notice things that were wrong in my my immediate environment. I noticed, for example, preparations for nuclear war going on in the United States.
What year was this? What year was this?
Oh, well, I guess I began to notice then during the late 1940s and early 1950s. I was born in 1941. I began to notice, for example, that we had shelter drills in school, that we had to hide under our desks and take cover from nuclear war. And also, there were metal dog tags passed out to us in the New York City school system with our names and addresses on these dog tags. And we were supposed to wear them all the time on a metal chain around our necks. And when we asked why, we were told that this was to identify our charred corpses or whatever was left of us after the bomb went off, so that if our parents still existed, they might learn what happened to us.
Good God.
I didn't
know. I mean, I knew about duck and cover and hiding under your desks and all that stupid business. But I didn't know you had to wear identification dog tags, for God's sake.
Well, in New York City, you did. And we were told never to take them off, even in the shower. And my father noticed the dog tag one day that I was wearing. And he said, "Larry, what's that?" And I it explained what it was and its purpose. And although he had no particular political interest, or at least no strong political views, and he wasn't a member of any anti-war group or left-wing group, he told me, "I throw it away, Larry." So as a dutiful child, that's what I did. I wish I kept it. Just for a souvenir, though.
So you didn't.
But,
you didn't get.
So I think preparations for nuclear war provided one thing that influenced me to think that something was wrong with the world and therefore should be changed. Another thing was racial discrimination in the United States. The fact is, racial segregation and discrimination in the South, and there were signs of racism in the North where I lived too. And my father happened to work for the Civil Rights Agency. For him, it was a civil service job, and he wasn't a particular zealot, although he was all for the law that banned discrimination at that time in employment on the basis of race, religious belief, or national origin. So I recognized something was wrong when there were lynchings taking place, when there was segregation going on, when there were all kinds of discriminatory practices in existence. And finally, I recognized that there seemed to be curbs on free thought in the United States. For example, the book Robin Hood, which many children had read, was actually banned from the public schools in a number of states, thanks to the fact that it seemed to be advocating what Mitt Romney would today call class war. That is, the poor taken from the rich. And that was obviously, it was felt, a subversive notion close to communism. And, of course, we couldn't have any communist thoughts in the United States. And, therefore, that book had to be kept away from the sensitive minds of children.
Right. Robin Hood was the book I read as a child. It was in a secondhand bookshop next to the pie shop where all the kids went and got nice pies for lunch, and I never was allowed to have one. I had to have brown bread and Kraft cheese sandwiches. Horrible. And I begged my father to get it for me. I must have been about 7. I read and read and reread that book so many times. So Robin Hood was one of my mentors, and I can't imagine or believe that could have been banned in the United States. I mean, anyway, give to the what the, and then Monty Python did a riff on Robin Hood and said, "Give to the rich and take from the poor."
Right.
John Cleese. That was
George W. Bush certainly did that.
Okay, that's right. And that's what, you know, the Republicans are actually suggesting. Give to the rich and take from the poor. They should play that Monty Python skit again. So, okay, you went to college then, Larry Whitner.
Yes.
And we want to know, why were those years so crucial to your development and your aspirations?
Well, Columbia College, where I went to school, had a sequence of humanities and contemporary civilization courses, as they were called. And these courses educated students like me to the ideas of the great thinkers, great philosophers, great political theorists, great educators of the past. They also gave us a sense of the broad sweep of history and of social change. And in many ways, this filled in the many gaps in my education up to that time. And I began to understand that ideas and social movements were very important. And I particularly liked the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment appealed to me because writers such as Voltaire and Diderot were challenging prejudice and ignorance and superstition and seeking to spread knowledge and enlightenment. And given the fact that I recognized things were wrong in the world and that many things had been wrong with the world in the past but had been challenged by these Enlightenment philosophers, I became convinced that that's what had to happen in the present world too, and indeed was happening. That throughout human history and right up to the present, there were a whole range of intellectuals and thinkers that had discovered injustice and had sought to challenge it with reason and knowledge, and therefore. These Enlightenment assumptions that underlay these great books and great thinkers courses became very important to me. They weren't just a matter of classroom training. They were a matter of how one should live one's life. Beyond that, though, of course, things were in the late 1950s and early 1960s when I was in college, things were heating up on the political front, too, for college students. The civil rights movement was sweeping across the nation, and particularly influencing college students. And the movement against nuclear testing was also influencing college students. And I became caught up in both campaigns. On the Columbia campus, my roommate and I helped to set up the Columbia chapter of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, which was very active in the freedom rides of the time, breaking up the segregated bus line system in the South and discrimination against people of color in public transportation. And we actually went down south in the summer of 1962, my roommate and I, and we were involved in the movement there. We helped out with voter registration work in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and then moved on to Jackson, Mississippi, and did voter registration work there. And in fact, weren't far from the office of Medgar Evers, who was murdered the following year in Jackson for doing just what we were doing, trying to assist black citizens to register to vote. In terms of nuclear testing, I became involved in my first protest demonstration. I joined others going down to Washington, D.C. and demonstrating against nuclear testing outside the White House. The Russians had resumed their nuclear tests after a U.S. Soviet-British moratorium on testing. And the United States seems on the verge of renewing its nuclear testing. It actually did renew it underground, but it hadn't done so above ground. And, of course, above ground nuclear testing spread nuclear fallout all over the world. So that my roommate and I decided that it was time to do something about this. So we joined others. We went down to Washington, and we picketed the Kennedy White House.
Well, very exciting times, those times. And in fact, your picketing and others led to the introduction of the test ban treaty, where testing above ground was banned by Jack Kennedy. And it was really interesting because I got to know Jerry Wiesner, who was a physicist in the Manhattan Project, and he was Jack Kennedy's science advisor.
Yes.
And he said one day Jack was standing with his hands behind his back, as he was wont to do, looking out the windows of the Oval Office, and it was raining. And outside were the picketers and a lot of women who were demonstrating, saying that their children could get leukemia or cancer from the weapons testing that was going on. And he looked out and the rain was falling on the windows, and he said to Jerry, "You mean, Jerry, there's radiation in that rain?" And Jerry Wiesner said, "Yes, Mr. President."
Well, I'm delighted he said that, because, in fact, the nuclear disarmament movement, groups like SANE and Women's Strike for Peace in the United States, were making that case. And the administration was very much on the defensive about that sort of thing. And I think that was a major factor behind the partial test ban treaty.
Oh, it definitely was. He admitted that, and so did Jerry Wiesner to me. But it's interesting, you know, Larry, as you talk, that we're getting to another point in history, I think, and we'll come back to you and your career in a minute. But when you look at what's happening now in the United States with the Occupy movement, and of course with the Arab Spring uprising all over the Middle East, but in America, the Occupy movement. It feels to me, because I have spoken at Liberty Square in New York, at Zuccotti Park twice, the feeling there was very profound for me. It was very peaceful, but it was very determined. It was obviously well-educated. And there were people, there were babies and children running around and dogs and older people in pinstripe suits. It was a whole sort of spectrum of society. But I felt more excited and more optimistic that night when I spoke than I had for even 20 years. And it feels like there's another big movement. Would you like to address that before we go back to your story, Larry Whitner?
Sure. Well, I think that there's been a lot of frustration in the United States and in other nations, too, about the growing disparity of wealth, the fact that the corporations and the wealthy have been growing richer and richer, and despite their mucking up the world economic system in the last few years, they've been doing very well, bailed out by numerous governments, and the people who have been paying the price for the bailout are the commoners, the vast mass of people who don't have vast wealth, as the Occupy people say, the 99%. So this notion of the 1% wealthy versus the 99%, and how the 1% are fattening themselves on they're feeding off the 99%. Is a very profound critique of the kind of economy, certainly the kind of skewed economy we have today. So I think it's a very cutting challenge to the establishment. And I'm not entirely surprised that in so many places the police have been called in to disperse the Occupy encampments, since it's a real challenge to the status quo and to the wealthy.
You know what really drives me crazy, Larry Whitner, is that when you're demonstrating against injustice such as the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the 1%, or against nuclear weapons and nuclear war, which would annihilate the whole life on the planet, or against nuclear power plants, which will induce epidemics of malignancy for the rest of time, or against global warming, which is really very serious. It's always the police who are on the side of the people doing the wickedness. And the people who are trying to stand up for the right thing, for humanity, for life on the planet and the like, they get jailed and they get arrested. Would you like to extrapolate a little bit on why the blasted police are always on the side of those doing the evil and not on the side of those trying to do good? What is it, Larry? And why do, I mean, surely the police should be here to protect us, the citizens, not the people doing the really wicked things.
Well, the police are just the pawns of the powerful, and to advance that metaphor, the kings and the queens and the bishops and the princes and so on the chessboard are the real power behind things, but the pawns often go along with that, just as the men and women in the armed forces often do. In conducting unjust wars. They didn't choose those wars, but they're being used by the powerful and the establishment for the advance of the powerful and the establishment. Now, sometimes, of course, things become so obvious and the consciences, even of the police, become stricken and they refuse to carry out the law or to listen to the authorities, and when the police will no longer enforce the law, or at least carry out the demands of the wealthy and powerful, then that society really is on the verge of revolution, or at least a transformation.
Do you think, are you hopeful that the Occupy movement will grow and will have a revolutionary ardor and force and outcome, Larry Whitner?
Well, it may in some places. I think that it may also feed into electoral politics. That is, I think that by injecting the issue of class into politics in ways that it's been absent in recent years and even recent decades, That has a potential to shake things up substantially and to go beyond single issue politics in the past, the politics of getting more for this group or that group. Mm-hmm. But by saying that the 99% should be served by the government, that has the possibility for vast coalitions that can overturn social structures and lead to a profound change. I notice, for example, that at least in the United States, but I suspect elsewhere, the labor movement has been very sympathetic to the Occupy movement. I know here in Albany, New York, the Albany County Central Federation of Labor, which is the AFL-CIO regional body, has been very supportive of the Occupy group. Has helped to fund them, and that sort of thing's been going on in other cities as well. So that there are some significant constituencies that are being appealed to by the Occupy movement, and together they may pioneer or at least instigate some very significant changes.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. We can see the influence that actually in Obama's recent speech on the economy, he's moving now to tax the rich. At
absolutely,
last.
Right.
And Romney is looking really not good because he's so filthy rich, and his money's been stashed in the Cayman Islands. And people are saying, "Hey, wait a minute! You know, we don't want someone representing us who has got his money, I think, by illicit means, meaning that, you know, he has fired and sacked lots of people when he worked for Bain. And I think that the Occupy movement has aroused a new consciousness in people seeking to say, look, wait a minute, we're fed up with this stuff now. And I think you're right, Larry. I think it's going to be carried out through the political process partly. And I think that the Occupy leaders are quite profound in their thinking and their philosophical notions. And it's a very interesting thing to watch, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. I should just add here that maybe 20 or more years ago, I've been active in my faculty staff union on the State University of New York campuses, which have something like 35,000 union members. And each year we were being hit with proposals to cut back funding for the SUNY, the State University of New York system. And there were other public service cutbacks demanded from governments, from governors, too, in New York State. And the reason was that the governors wanted to cut taxes for the rich, and to do that, they had to cut back public services. So I went to my union leaders, and I proposed that we put out bumper stickers saying tax the rich.
Yep.
Since obviously progressive taxation would deal with the budget shortfall and would adequately fund public services. But the union leaders didn't want to do that at the time, and they shied off from that. So I went to a local labor movement spinoff in which I was involved called the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District. And I said, you know, 10 little letters on a bumper sticker here in the state's capital on cars driving around would be seen by the politicians who meet here in Albany and decide on legislation for New York State. And if they saw this slogan, tax the rich, on a lot of cars driving around in the city, they might get the impression that the public wants them to do this sort of thing. So the Solidarity Committee discussed this, and we decided to purchase 250 bumper stickers, to order them custom-made, that we would sell to local union people and others and hope they would put them on their car bumpers. So we did that, and we sold out within 1 or 2 weeks. And then we ordered more, and we ordered more, and ultimately we sold thousands of them. And that slogan is being used throughout New York State today. I see it all around Albany, and it's being used around the country. So I'm delighted, and I think this shows us that that kind of movement, its time has finally come.
Yeah, that's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I'm interviewing Professor Larry Whitner, who is an award-winning American historian, writer, an activist for peace and social justice, as you hear. Now, I'm very interested, Larry, you said you've had difficulties in combining activism with academia. Would you like to extrapolate on that?
Well, in theory, you would think that, given my Enlightenment assumptions, that knowledge is linked to social change, that universities would welcome this combination of intellectual life and a changing the world. But in fact, particularly administrators on university campuses tend not to like it at all.
Bureaucrats.
So at Vassar College, although I'd written a great deal, I'd done my scholarly work very well, and I have very large classes as compared to my colleagues, and the student evaluations of my teaching were very good. Despite this, I was turned down for tenure there, thanks to the fact that I was making waves on the campus. By that time, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there were major demonstrations on college and university campuses against the Vietnam War, for black studies programs and to civil rights more generally, and a whole range of other issues. And my participation in these sorts of things, including a movement to expose the IBM Corporation and the kind of military work it was doing for the U.S. government in connection with the U.S. war in Vietnam. All of that sort of thing horrified the administration. And eventually I was turned down for tenure, as were the other faculty who were involved in these peace and social justice movements. And for a time, I found it very difficult to find other jobs. Ultimately, I did find one at State University of New York at Albany, in large part thanks to the fact that I was involved in a nationwide scholarly group called the Conference on Peace Research and History. And some people from that group happened to be teaching in the history department at SUNY Albany. And so I was, when a job opening came up, they thought of me, as well as other people, and I was interviewed for the job, and I got it. But even there were administrators on the campus, especially the dean at the time and his friends in the administration, who saw to it that I was kept in a very lowly position. And in fact, they had to file new paperwork at the time to make sure that I wasn't hired for the post that I'd been interviewed for, but was hired on a very temporary basis as a one-year lecturer. So I was barely hired at SUNY Albany, and for some years I was kept in that very tenuous position. But ultimately, they needed publishing faculty, and since I was one of the fairly few heavily published faculty members in my department, a department that had lost its PhD program thanks to the fact that insufficient faculty publications were being turned out, I was finally offered tenure, and so I was safe. And then finally, another drawback to being an activist intellectual came in terms of funding. I was particularly active when it came to doing scholarly work in studying peace and disarmament movements. I've been not only involved in them in terms of activism, but also in terms of studying them as a scholar. But that was the sort of thing that people controlling the various pots of money that are used for research funding, foundations and other organizations that fund scholarly research, that was the kind of research they didn't want to fund. They wouldn't have minded my counting the number of missiles on nuclear warheads if I was studying that sort of thing, but they didn't like the fact that I was studying the efficacy of the anti-nuclear movement in terms of getting rid of nuclear weapons. That was something that horrified them. So I had great difficulty, in spite of splendid reviews for my books, in obtaining research grants. But ultimately, I got enough of them so that I scraped by and I could do the necessary research. Still, people who were doing much more obscure studies, not quite the traditional studies in the Middle Ages of the number of angels that might fit on the head of a pin, but comparable things in modern scholarly studies, those people easily got funded, and I had much greater difficulties.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Conservatism means people want to stay in their comfort zones, don't rock the boat, don't do anything that might hinder their, I suppose, professional status, and don't rock the boat in society. And I could recount to you what happened to me. I was a young doctor who'd trained at Harvard in the treatment of cystic fibrosis, and I went back to Adelaide in Australia to establish a cystic fibrosis clinic there. At the time, I was kind of leading the movement against the French atomic test in the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, I know that, yeah.
Where we got a lot of fallout, and I was on television a lot, but I was also, actually at the time, I was working 80 hours a week as a pediatric intern to become a pediatrician and a member of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. And I was asked to go to Paris to see the French government with a delegation of Australians, and the medical superintendent called me into his office and said, "You're not to go." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, we've had a lot of complaints about you." And I said, "Has anyone complained about my work and my treatment of the patients?" "No," he said. I said, "Well, what was it?" And he said, "Well, the wives of the consultants are complaining about you. You're getting too much publicity." And I said, "Well, if I'm not to go," which really astounded me, actually, and I said, "Well, if I'm not to go, I have to tell the press where I'm not going." And he did a double take. And he said, "Okay, you're to go, but you're not to talk to the media." And I thought, "You silly man." And then when I travelled, I did establish a cystic fibrosis clinic, which was the first one in Australia with the best results in Australia now, longevity-wise. I then went to Harvard for a sabbatical, and I came. Before I left, he said, "Now," he called me into his office again, he said, "If you return, you will not get a permanent job in the hospital." And, you know, I had established a clinic, and you can't run the clinic as the director. And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because of your political beliefs." So I totally sympathize and vibe with you when you talk about your difficulties, and it really it gives me the dry rot that these people stand in the way of really important change. So I want to now talk about the role of intellectuals in the peace movement. I'm really interested in that, Larry. Would you like to extrapolate on that?
Okay. Well, it became very striking during the Vietnam War, in any case, that intellectuals were not just leaders of the anti-Vietnam War movement, but also the masses of people who were protesting, university faculty members, university students, other members of the educated middle class, formed the vast bulk of the activists against the Vietnam War. So at that point, I wouldn't have any difficulty convincing people that that the intellectuals played a major role. Since then, it's not as clear, but I think, nonetheless, if one looks under the surface, one still finds that the peace movement, by and large, is a movement of the educated middle class. I don't mean that it's totally that, but still, the educated middle class plays a disproportionate role in the peace movement. And I think a key reason for that is that education develops some degree of critical thinking. And if one thinks about warfare, and especially about nuclear warfare, but even warfare generally speaking, you begin to see through the patriotic propaganda to the reality that war is a very counterproductive method of dealing with problems. It's very costly in terms of lives and resources, and it threatens, through nuclear war at least, to destroy the world. So that the educated middle class, probably more than the average person who would watch Rupert Murdoch television or read his newspapers and so on, the educated middle class, more than most, I think, was drawn to protest against the folly of war. And I know that in terms of peace groups I've been involved in, such as Peace Action. Peace Action is the successor to the Nuclear Freeze Campaign and to SANE in the United States, and is the largest peace group in the United States. Groups like Peace Action have a substantial number of faculty members and other intellectuals involved in their activities, and they do very useful work. Now, one problem, of course, they face is how to transcend that education gap in society, and that's a real difficulty.
What do you mean about the education? You've got the need to bridge the gap unfulfilled by the mass media between intellectuals and the public. That's a very, very important topic. So enlarge upon that, Larry.
Oh, sure. Well, a key problem is that although more people than in the past are attending college and university, and thus thinking more broadly and having more knowledge than any time in the past, the fact is that these same people, of course, are being bombarded by the commercial mass media and are being miseducated. And furthermore, those who don't go to college and university don't get the knowledge that the colleges and universities provide for them, and receive the vast bulk of their education from the television programs they watch or the radio programs they listen to. In the United States, talk radio.
Or Facebook or Twitter or...
Yeah, all those sorts of things. Although I think those are much less damaging than the commercial mass media generally. And therefore, they're missing... educated. I think George Orwell was right when he challenged the traditional Enlightenment notion that with greater knowledge the world could be made a better place. What Orwell pointed out in his dystopian novel 1984 was that people could be miseducated with propaganda. And might end up believing things that were not true. And the more they were hooked in to the mass media, such as television, which is what he was really focusing on as the miseducator of the time, the more people were hooked into that communications medium, the less they would know and the more susceptible they would be to war propaganda and to ignorance. So it's that gap between ignorance and the knowledge that many intellectuals have that is not being filled satisfactorily by the mass media. To be sure, your program and others seek to fill that gap, but nonetheless, the vast bulk of the time on television and in the airwaves is filled by trivia at best and miseducation at worst.
I agree, Larry Whitman. Let me tell you my experience or a little bit of it. In the early 80s, when I was a kind of major part of the freeze movement and the peace movement, the anti-nuclear weapons movement, I gave a speech at a symposium that Physicians for Social Responsibility held in Los Angeles, and there was a woman there called Pat Kingsley, who was an agent who was actually one of the leading agents in the country for the film stars like Jodie Foster and, you know, all the major ones, Candy Bergen and Lily Tomlin and Sally Field. And she got kind of turned on, said she would work for me. And I said, well, you know, that's nice, but I can't pay you. She said, I'll do it for free. So what she would do for, you know, like 60 Minutes or Good Morning America or Merv Griffin or Phil Donahue, these shows, she'd say, look, I'll give you Sally Field and Lily Tomlin if you'll take Helen Caldicott. Well, no one wanted a sort of boring woman Australian doctor in a tweed suit talking about the dangers of nuclear war. I mean, that's enough to turn any audience off. But they did want the film stars. So she would use them as the hook to hang my hat on. And I remember one very interesting time. We had 1 hour on Donahue, and Lily Tomlin was parading up and down the halls while Sally was getting a makeup put on. And when Lily came on for half an hour, she covered the whole spectrum of nuclear war problems, the number of weapons, what would happen if they exploded, the whole thing. So when I came on, she'd really covered the whole waterfront. But through that mechanism, and then Kingsley got me in Time, Life, Vogue, Family Circle, Women's, you know, Home Journal and stuff. And through those media outlets, both in print, television and radio, we were able to educate the Americans to say, hey, you know, it's not better to be dead than red. Nuclear war is going to be bad for our health. And it seems to me, Larry Whitner, that we need a similar sort of movement or program now to get the people who understand on television to educate the masses who do not know what's going on at the moment. Would you have any ideas about that or notions about how that could be achieved, Larry?
Well, I'm not sure, really. I can talk a great deal about the peace movement and the labor movement and the racial justice movement in which I've been involved for decades, for a half century now. But I really don't know very much about the mass media in terms of the nuts and bolts. I just see the results.
Mm.
I wrote this book, Working for Peace and Justice, in part because I was trying to educate the general public about the necessity of these kinds of social change, but also about the enjoyment that an activist has in working for a just and peaceful society. So I use the book form, but unfortunately, I think many people don't read books,
yeah.
And if they do read books, they read cookbooks, books about movie stars, and so on.
Yes, well, that's that's absolutely right. People don't tend to sit down and have the attention span to go through a whole book these days, although your work's been extremely important. But I do think the media is determining the fate of the earth. What did Marshall McLuhan say about the media? The media is us or something?
Media is the message.
The media is the message. The media is the message. And it couldn't be more important than it is today. So, Larry Whitner, I'd invite you to put your mind to this particular problem, because I do think that what Jefferson said so many years ago is so accurate. An informed democracy. Informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And somehow we've got to manipulate ourselves to get on the media. You know, Greenpeace is always successful, but I don't want to be climbing towers and, you know, taking on the whalers, the Japanese whalers down in the Southern Ocean in little boats and stuff. But there must be a way for us to get on the media. And if we're so intellectual and so intelligent, right, you know,
right.
There must be a way for us to work this out so that we are covered by the media. I think the Occupy movement is one approach, which is very important, but there have to be other approaches. So I think you and I, Larry Whitner, should put our heads together and sort of try and work out a scheme to kind of educate everyone to save the planet. I'd just like to finish, because we're nearly at the end of our interview, for you to reminisce and say, has your life been deeply rewarding and satisfying? How do you feel in your gut about how you've lived your life and what you've done, Larry Whitner?
Oh, I'm delighted. I think that people often waste their lives on trivial things. Now, of course, they have to earn enough money to feed their families and provide for housing and a whole range of other things. But beyond that, there are all sorts of other things they can be doing in their lives. And I've held regular jobs, too, teaching jobs for the most part. But I've also managed to do other things. I've been involved in racial equality sit-ins, challenging South African apartheid and challenging the segregation system in the South. I've been involved in unions that have supported poor people who are struggling for a decent wage and who are seeking to get health care for their children through medical insurance coverage. I've been involved in peace groups that have helped to stop wars and especially stop the slide toward nuclear war. And that gives me a very good feeling, a feeling that I've done something useful with my life, that I haven't wasted it, and that there's no necessary contradiction between being an activist and leading a decent life. People sometimes think that there's that being an activist is a recipe for martyrdom, but I don't think it has to be. Although obviously some people have martyred themselves, but I don't think it has to be. I think that the good life combines home and family and friendships and love with changing the world and making it a better place. And I think that's a satisfying and often exciting sort of life.
Well, when you get in your grave, Larry, you can get in your grave with a clear conscience, right?
Right, absolutely.
Well, on that note, which is a happy note, I thank you very much for this wonderful interview and for sharing some aspects of your quite stupendous life. We'll all be very appreciative, and you're a very good model for the rest of us, Larry Whitner.
Thank you very much, Alan. So are you.
Well, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Professor Lawrence S. Whitner, an award-winning American historian, writer, and activist for peace and social justice, who's just published a book called Working for Peace and Justice, published by the University of Tennessee Press. It's his wonderful autobiography, which I really do suggest everyone reads for inspiration about how to lead a really productive and compassionate life. Thanks for listening today, and we'll be back with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.